G'day and welcome to the Garden Clinic Digs Deeper podcast. Permaculture has resonated with the world's population since its creation in Australia in the 70s. Such a fantastic sort of principles for living. Kirsten Bradley and Nick Ritter left the city to start a little permaculture farm called Milkwood 10 years ago. Now, their dream was to live a simple life within their means. And since then, they've been busy growing food, sharing their skills wherever they could, travelling around the world, building biochar stoves, creating rooftop city community gardens, and teaching permaculture along the way. Originally in Mudgee, and now they currently live, grow, forage, and keep bees on their 2-acre permaculture farm near Daylesford.
The best garden in the street.
G'day, Graham Ross here. Now, you all know I love my gardening, and we all know that Sea Sol is simply fantastic for keeping your garden healthy and looking great. But did you know that Sea Sol reduces transplant shock and dramatically increases the plant's survival rate when they're newly planted? Now, look, it's like an insurance policy for your plants. So when you're planting out your seedlings and new plants in your garden, don't just water them in, Sea Sol your plants.
Don't forget the Sea Sol.
The most wonderful book crossed my table called Milkwood, and I'm so thrilled to get the author, or one of the authors, of this wonderful new permaculture book on the line with me today. And so the book was written by Kirsten Bradley and Nick Ritter, and I've got Nick on the phone with me today. G'day, Nick.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks so much for your time. Now, the Milkwood permaculture has been going on for really a decade now, inspiring people all around the world with your Instagram and blogs and so forth. You really are a nexus of education for permaculture principles and for us city slickers to, you know, adopt as many as we can in our small gardens. I think that's where, you know, you guys really get to permeate this incredible education. And now with the book, it's all there for us to take home. Where did the Milkwood idea start?
Quite a while back now, about 12 years ago, we were living in Melbourne, and both Kirsten and I grew up in the country. We were living in Melbourne at that stage, working in technology and in the arts, and we really wanted to kind of simplify our life a little bit. So we decided to move to the country, try to build a house, get pregnant and start a small business all at the same time.
So, why do we do that all at once? I don't know. Human nature.
I'm not sure. But yeah,
Setting ourselves up to fail. No.
Well, we really wanted to I suppose, we yearn for that simplicity that I think a lot of people yearn for, that comes, I suppose, is represented in our mind as moving to the country. And we did want to reconnect very much with place and with where our food came from and place to raise a kid. That was what motivated us, and that's still what motivates us now 10 years later. It's just, I think we've gotten a little wiser as the time's gone by.
The five topics that you really concentrate on in this book, you know, the subtitle is, you know, Real Skills for Down-to-Earth Living, is something that we can all glean from. Honestly, I'm so inspired by that seaweed chapter. My girlfriend and I have already made a seaweed play date to go along our little coastal strip at Catherine Hill Bay to see what we can find in the spring holidays. So you must be just inspiring a whole generation of people to get out there and just delve a little bit more into the coastline to see what seaweeds are out there and identify them, but just use them for edible purposes, not to mention sort of fertilizing purposes. I make a seaweed tea and have for years, but I never thought to actually dry it for a sort of seaweed kombu.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things that people don't realize how edible most seaweeds are. It's a little bit different from going out foraging for mushrooms or plants, in the fact that there are very, very few seaweeds out there that you can't eat. They're almost universally edible. We've only managed to find one so far that isn't great for you, and it only grows in Western Australia as far as we understand. So it's pretty much a smorgasbord.
It's amazing. So if you're foraging for seaweed, what's the main option in terms of actually harvesting it?
Well, the first thing to be aware of is that we want to be responsible forages and not damage the individual organisms or the ecosystem that they come from. So that's kind of slightly made easier by the laws in New South Wales that state really clearly that you can't harvest live seaweed. So we're not going to be cutting it from the rocks and harvesting whole bull kelp from while we're going snorkeling or scuba diving. That's clearly against the rules. Every time a storm rolls through, there's going to be seaweed which is dislodged from its holdfast and be floating in the ocean and washed up onto the beaches. And use your nose and the stuff that's fresh, you know, maybe still just floating in the waves there or is clearly fresh on the beach. That stuff is fantastic.
Well, it sounds wonderful, and there's so many times where that seaweed's just floating in and around the surf break, especially on my slightly rocky shores. And so that's a really wonderful idea. So how would you sort of care for it or process it to dry the seaweed for human consumption?
If it's in good condition, then, I mean, using it fresh straight away is one of the easiest things to do. So just depending on the variety or the species, then many of them can be used fresh as is. Just, you know, chopped and sprinkle a lemon juice and added to a salad can be incredible. Other ones, if you want to use it later, add it to a soup or a stew, or we always add a little bit of kelp to our beans when we cook our beans.
What?
Those ones, then if you want to preserve it for later, it's as easy as taking it home and putting it over the washing line at home, and in a day or two it dries, break it up and put it in a jar and that's it. It stores incredibly well once it's dry.
Isn't that wonderful? And obviously just full of nutrient.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing about seaweed. And, you know, the ocean obviously is a completely different ecosystem with a completely different set of minerals and nutrients that become available to either us directly when we eat it or through our garden if we use it as a fertilizer.
Well, we've been using seaweeds and seaweed products for years in the gardening industry and, you know, using it more as a tonic to build the strength of the walls, the cell walls in our plants.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that's usually done in a liquid form or in a granule form, or collecting your own seaweed, just making sure that you're within the requirements of your local council.
Yeah, some councils have specific rules. Generally, it's around about a maximum of 20 kilos per day per person.
Which is huge.
Yeah.
It's more than you'd ever need.
It's kind of just enough to stop you becoming commercial, really.
Right. And look, it's a fantastic resource, isn't it, Nick, for fertilising the garden? So how would you use it as a mulch?
Well, you can just use it. If you've got enough and a consistent supply and it's regular enough, it actually works quite well as a surface mulch. It takes a while to break down. If it's a bigger, heavier seaweed like a kelp or something like that, it might be a little rough as a mulch. So you can just tuck it under. If it's kept moist, it breaks down fairly quickly. So if you tuck it underneath an existing mulch, that works quite well. We've thrown it through a wood chipper. I'm drying it out and throwing it through a wood chipper and then adding it as a sort of almost like a granular fertilizer.
Yeah, wow.
And then, of course, making a digestion or a ferment of it by adding it to and submerging it in a drum of water and mixing in some of the other land weeds that grow around your place as a way of getting their nutrients back into the soil as well and letting it sit for a couple of months. Until it no longer smells so bad.
Yeah.
At first it'll go really stinky, but after time it'll settle down a little bit, and then just watering it down and adding it as a liquid fertiliser.
I always feel like that's a nice sort of mid-spring thing to do once the comfrey has shot back again from its winter slumber, and you can harvest those nice fresh comfrey leaves, which are so nutritious with potassium and borage and nettle, and then make that seaweed tea. And it's just like such a great homemade fertiliser for your summer crops like tomatoes and strawberries. It's brilliant on tomatoes, isn't it?
Yeah, it's that regular feeding that a liquid fertiliser allows you to do really well. You know, it lets it gets penetrate down to the roots, and it's you can have it there literally on tap for when you need it once every couple of weeks.
And I suppose that negates, you know, the idea of actually store-bought fertilisers as well.
Well, I mean, we like to try to do lots of things ourselves. You shouldn't beat yourself up too much if you can't do it all yourself.
No.
And you know, we've been a user for a long time of you know, liquid seaweed fertilizers, and that was actually one of the things that triggered us getting into seaweed in the first place. We were using, you know, liquid seaweed as a fertilizer to raise our seedlings and the like, and we were going down to the beach with we're visiting family in the holidays, seeing all this beach cast seaweed which was just getting picked up by the council and taken to landfill. And we thought, oh, well, wait up, there's an opportunity. We can divert it from the waste stream and use it to fertilise, in that case, our market garden. We had 1,500 square metre market garden that we were growing food for students for our courses. And it made perfect sense to us all of a sudden that, hey, let's divert this stuff and turn it into yummy vegetables. It took us a little while longer to realise that you could actually eat most of it straight.
Well, I think that's the secret to this book and the significance, I suppose, of the book is there's so many books out there, but this is years and years and years of testing and trying and experimenting. And you've poured all that research and development into this one very thick tome. And then we get to, as the reader, benefit from those years of experience. And even though we've all, you know, use seaweed and so forth in our gardens for so long, you just look at it with such a different perspective. It's such a valuable thing for us to be able to, yeah, copy, I suppose.
It's been an interesting journey. You know, we've been, when we moved to the country, and we moved to my parents' farm up near Mudgee at the time that they owned that. You know, I'd grew up on a national park and we'd lived on farms before. And we had some idea of how to manage the land, but we also knew that we needed to learn more. And we started bringing people to our farm to teach us. And we also needed to find a livelihood for ourselves. And we invited other people to come along. And sure enough, they wanted to come and learn. So over the last 10 years, I think we've run maybe 600, could be 700 courses now.
Wow.
With teachers from all over the world. And that's been an amazing learning experience for us. And we wanted to share some of that knowledge a little wider. Courses are great, but you can't always get the time and the travel to come to something that's happening face-to-face. So this book has allowed us to spread some of that information a little wider. And so far, the response has been fantastic.
Well, I'm sure you and Kirsten are just so proud of it. It's like a baby, really.
It is, and you're never quite sure how your kids are going to turn out, but I think this one's turned out okay.
I think it's a ripper. It's a really awesome. I was kind of like, at the beginning, I was just like, oh, only just like, well, it's about tomatoes and mushrooms and beekeeping and seaweed and wild food. And I was like, oh, just five topics, but it's just so in depth. And tomatoes are definitely my favourite topic of cropping, growing and conversation.
Oh, hope we got things right there.
You did. All my little tricks of the trade, you knew. It's really good. I went to a party once, Nick, and my friend of a friend, and he was a hort guy, 7 foot and carrot top, bright orange hair. And we started talking, and then we realised how much we like tomatoes. And then we're like, oh, blah, blah, you know, chat, 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 chat. And someone came up and to talk, you know, oh, hi, how are you? And then we're like, oh, we're just talking tomatoes. And then we're like, oh, well, we'll just leave you at it. 2 hours and 2.5 hours later, they came up again. We're still talking about tomatoes. It's just such an in-depth subject for those who love tomatoes and those who grow them, knowing that there's thousands and thousands of different types of tomatoes out there to grow. And this is really just the precursor of the tomato season.
You could write 500 pages on tomatoes. You know, we've been exposed to so many great subjects over the years, but when we were asked to write this book, we kind of had a think, and we thought, do we want to try and cover everything and only have a page or two for each subject, or do we want to do one thing and go into it in massive depth, you know, try to establish ourselves as the leading expert on one subject? And we kind of decided that it was good to recognise that those people and those ideas that had been brought to us, and not try to claim that we knew the most about a subject, because we've met the people who do know the most about those subjects, and instead give people a really good head start into those subjects, and then, you know, point them to where they can learn more if they need to. So hence the five subjects. It's really, I suppose, five kind of separate books in one. But all those five subjects are things that are deeply personal and to us and that we're really passionate about. In the case of tomatoes, my grandfather and grandmother had an amazing market garden and little farm in Fairfield in Western Sydney. When I was a kid. Yeah, so we lived on a national park in far western New South Wales, and we used to come to the city. And my experience of coming to the city was wandering amongst 5 acres of tomatoes, helping my grandfather prune the tomatoes and train them up stakes and tie them all up with stockings.
Did he use the determinate and indeterminate types? Do you remember?
No, just the climbers.
Oh, just the climbers. Oh, right.
Yeah. They were all staked onto the wooden tomato stakes. I remember thousands and thousands of these wooden tomato stakes and all tied up tall to try and get the most crop. And as a kid, you know, that was my experience of coming to Sydney, walking along these rows of tomatoes. Yeah, that smell is still, you know.
Oh, that tobacco smell.
Yeah, it's still something that, I don't know, I know it's not, most people don't talk about it as being a pleasant smell, but there's something that triggers in my heart and my memory of my grandparents.
Oh, there's nothing like wandering around tomatoes and brushing past, but it really, you know, overwhelmingly you do understand that tomatoes are in the tobacco family for a reason, that Solanaceae family.
Totally.
And you've got some great ways and structures of growing them, whether it's like your A-frame trellis, which I call a tunnel teepee, or wigwams and square cages and stakes. And I love, and I often tell people if they're growing heirloom varieties that breed true to type every year, that they could chuck them in a pot of soil and put a cover over them and then just unleash them, water them, and they'll start sprouting the year after. And you've got that compost seed bank method too, which is a ripper of a trick, isn't it?
It's funny because I can be a little bit obsessive at times and, you know, really quite specific about how I do things. And that one's a bit about letting go and accepting that the plant knows how to grow.
It's so successful because, of course, the seed is going to grow when it's given light and water. And then as soon as you do that, it shoots. And then you've got a forest of little tomato seedlings all going. I absolutely love that technique. Well, it just takes the sort of scariness or the intimidation of, you know, growing your own tomatoes from seed, which, look, I think is a thing. People go, I don't like, you know, growing tomatoes from seed. They're so tricky. I'll just go and buy some seedlings from the nurseries. But I say, look, if you go to the nursery, you're getting a percentage, like a 1%, you know, range of available tomatoes. You might like peach-coloured ones, like hillbilly, or lovely big yellow tomatoes, or very Watscopican peach ones, or, you know, all of these different kinds of types of peach, like colours of tomatoes, just rather than the small offering on offer at a nursery. Although that's a good place to start.
We really encourage people to, you know, to become stewards of a variety. It's a lovely thing to have your family variety of tomatoes that you can, you don't necessarily have to breed a new one. Even just saving the same seeds year in, year out is a fantastic way to sort of build that connection with your food and your place and learn how to grow, you know, one thing really well.
Yeah, I love that too. And when you do that and you're sort of known for that, then you can start giving them away to friends and family. Go, I've got, you know, 20. I did hillbilly this year, which is
they're fantastic.
They're great. It's an 1850, I think, heirloom from Pennsylvania. And it's a big, thick ox heart, but it's peach coloured. And when you cut in, it's got a sort of a star in the centre. And I grew 300. And I only needed 5.
You had to give a few of those away.
I gave them all away to garden clinic members. And, I'm just popping over to someone's house that I met on Instagram, actually, tomorrow to give her one. And I just wanted to, you know, spread a little bit of that love. But that hillbilly tomato, it's just so easy to save the seed. And it's just, you know, brought so much joy to people.
There's so many great varieties, especially, you know, coming out of America. I'm just amazed at how passionate people are about their tomato diversity there. And hopefully, you know, we can all instill a little bit of that passion for them here in Australia.
Look, the book is just so many interesting recipes as well. I was thinking of the fermented tomato salsa recipe, which will go beautifully on a Taco Tuesday.
Yeah. Well, getting a bit of that acid ferment that comes out, it's like it's got lemon juice all the way through it, but it hasn't.
Oh, just, yum. And know, and that little tip ferment that you've got here of, you know, making that tomato salsa, but just adding a little tablespoon of the clear liquid that sits on top of the plain yogurt. If you've got a buying a biodynamic yogurt or something and just getting that little bit of whey and using that,
that as a startup.
Oh, that's a brilliant idea. I never would have thought of that.
You don't need to, but it's a nice little trick that sometimes can give your ferments a bit of a kickstart, because that lactic acid producing bacteria that's in the yogurt culture will go crazy when it hits the vegetable matter as well.
So many wonderful topics. And I know that you're going sort of around the country. I hope it's not too arduous for you, you know, as you launch the book.
It's been fun, actually. It's nice to, you know, connect to a bunch of different people that we, you know, wouldn't usually get to see, and catching up with old friends around the place as we move around. It's been really lovely.
Oh, that's good. I was thrilled. I mean, I have never really, I mean, on purpose, tried to grow mushrooms. And I love the photo of you and Kirsten with inoculated mushrooms. I just think that is such, again, a wealth of new ideas for me to discover and to sort of get better at. My children are constantly telling me, Mum, we need more vegetarian recipes and more vegan recipes, and you know, those mushrooms, to be able to grow them yourself is incredible. Is it easy or just a bit tricky?
It's like anything. You know, when you first start, that you're probably, you know, going to need a couple of goes to get it working really well.
A bit like starting your own sourdough.
Yeah, or even growing tomatoes. You know, often the first time that people try something, it's going to be a bit of a challenge. But I think that the mushrooms are these sort of mysterious things that pop up after rain, and for a long time people didn't understand what made them grow. And, you know, they're not plants and they're not animals. They're some strange place in between. And I think that there's a little bit of fear involved with mushrooms. So it's understandable that, you know, it doesn't necessarily come natural to people on how to do that. But once you've given it a go and practiced a few times, we've got some techniques in there that are really easy.
Well, and, you've got this wonderful technique that's using a bucket.
The bucket technique is dead simple. It's probably the easiest technique that we've found to be able to grow mushrooms. And I've taught, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people how to do this in mushroom cultivation courses, the 2-day course that we teach. And the one thing that you need, there's only one skill that you need, and that's persistence. It'll work. You've just got to keep trying. And, you know, they're fantastic. They grow on waste material, and we're just basically taking some straw or sawdust or wood chip or a combination of those things and pasteurizing them in some hot water.
Yeah.
And then draining them and then mixing them in with the inoculant, which is what we call grain spawn, usually is what we're using. And we mix all those together at a ratio of about 10 to 1, so 10% grain spawn and 90% the straw and sawdust, and then packing them into a bucket, which we've drilled some holes in.
And where would, so it does sound so easy. I mean, and it looks quite simple to do. I think that's where I might start. Where would I purchase the spawn?
Yeah, the grain spawn, there's a couple of different suppliers in Australia, quite a few kind of really small scale ones that are all around Australia. But most of them they're so small scale that they can be a little relaxed about getting things to you. But there's one really good one that we use all the time, and that's Russell at Aussie Mushroom Suppliers. He's been fantastic.
And is it a mail order thing? Can you...
Yeah, you could just order them online. So if you search on grain spawn, grain because it's being grown on wheat or barley or millet or something like that. So it's been grown on a sterilized grain. And then you just choose the species that you want to grow. And there are so many more species that you can grow compared to what you can buy in the shops. You know, you might have seen oyster mushrooms, and you can grow all the oyster mushrooms very easily at home, the ones that you see in the shops, and shiitake and the like, and, you know, maybe even a nokitake that you've seen in the shops. But when was the last time you saw pia pino or lion's mane or reishi or turkey tails or all the other varieties that you can grow at home quite easily? You don't see those ones in the shops. So
well, you very, very rarely see them at farmers markets too. And if you do see a sort of a slightly bigger variety of mushrooms at farmers markets, they're so extraordinarily expensive. So which sort of mushroom do you think a beginner should start with?
Oh, definitely what we call the oyster complex.
Okay.
So it's not because they're complex to grow. It's because there are so many different varieties and the boundaries between species is pretty blurred. So, you know, the classic is, the Latin is Pleurotus austriatus, or the pearl oyster mushroom. And it's probably the easiest to start with and one of the fastest growing and one of the most productive. And it'll overcome just about any competition to make sure that it's the one that fruits.
Wow. Okay. Well, you've inspired me. I think I might do that in the spring holidays. And what kind of position would I need to position the bucket in?
There's two kind of phases to it. And being in the bucket is one of the things that makes it easy to move between the two locations. So after we inoculate it and we pack it into the bucket, seal the bucket up. I usually cover the holes that I've already drilled in the sides of the buckets with surgical tape, micropore tape. Then once that bucket's packed nice and tight, I actually just pop it under my lounge at home.
Oh, wow.
And they sit there. They actually, during that phase, they like to have pretty much the same conditions that you or I would be comfortable in, sort of low 20s in temperature and no direct sunlight. So we're basically keeping them, you know, the old cliche of keeping them in the dark. Under the lounge is great because it's warm and it's stable. Then they'll take 1 to 2 weeks to fully colonize and consolidate, probably about 2.5 weeks before they've fully consolidated and digested a good percentage of that straw or sawdust. And then they'll want to be able to fruit. So when they want to fruit, that's when we have to move them into a very, very humid environment. So almost a cloud is what you're after.
Like the bathroom? So,
possibly, but if you've got even next to a pond outside, maybe under a tree fern, or it could be, in your bathroom where you might increase the humidity a little bit by using just a hand mister to mist all the way around the mushrooms, but not directly on them, just to try and make the air very, very humid. And a little bit cooler is good too.
Oh,
so
okay.
That's why moving them outside down the side of the house, you know, somewhere where there's already moss growing or ferns covering.
So a little bit like that southern side of the house where it's mossy and lichen-y.
Yeah. I've built a specialist fruiting chamber on the side of our place, which is actually in the book as well. And all I did was got some old shower screens and joined them together to make what looks kind of like a telephone booth. Those in that, I've got a little greenhouse humidifier that runs. It's got a sensor and measures how humid the place is, and it increases the humidity to the stage where it's like a cloud in there. That's perfect. But that's only if you really want to grow kilos and kilos and kilos of mushrooms per week. If you're just starting out, the best thing to do is just the coolest, dampest place that you can find around your home. Works great.
Well, I cannot say how thrilled I am to get a little window in the milkwood world and just sit and have the privilege of chatting to you, Nick. It's just so beautiful.
Oh, thanks, Linda. It's lovely talking to you too.
It's really lovely. I'm going, really been so inspired to start mushrooms myself. The tomatoes are going gangbusters, and then I think beekeeping is the next on my list.
Yeah. I mean, even if you're not going to go to the extent of getting a hive yourself.
Oh, I'm definitely getting a hive. I live in the middle of 350 hectares of basically Melaleuca forest.
Oh, beautiful.
So I think the Melaleuca honey will be a ripper, but I've just got to work out, my beekeeping strategy.
Yeah, there's a bunch of different ways that you can go with beekeeping, different sort of hive designs. And, you know, again, that can be a bit challenging for people when they first start. They kind of can be overwhelmed with
kind
the choices.
Like you need all the information in your book, but you also sort of need a mentor.
It's a really good idea. It's one of the things we recommend, that when people first start beekeeping, that they connect with other beekeepers around them.
And there's lots of beekeeping clubs and groups around.
There are. Everybody, beekeeping is one of those things. Everybody has their own special way of doing it. And it is really worth finding a mentor to help you start and to give you the confidence to move forward with it. There are lots of different ways of doing it. And, you know, we have our own particular favourites that we've learnt, and our particular favourite hive designs. But I think having that support is really valuable to you.
Well, thank you, darling. And you know what? Graham joins me by wishing you and that lovely Kirsten of yours a happy anniversary, wedding anniversary for your 14th year. It's an incredible, I suppose, you know, getting to this point in our lives and being so inspiring. But also, I suppose, just putting those new roots down in Daylesford must feel really good to connect with that local community.
It's been fantastic. I mean, we were invited down to live there by David Holmgren and his partner, Sue Dennett, who have this incredible property that we live on now called Meliodora. It's just 2 acres, but it's got 140 fruit and nut trees of 120 varieties. And
and how long has David been on that property for?
34 years. So it's really well developed.
Wow. So he was the co-creator of permaculture.
Yeah, that's right. He and Bill Mollison originated the idea, and way back in the mid 70s, and it's been now taken up worldwide as a sort of framework for people to reconnect with the place that they are.
And I love that too. That it is so sort of there's no rules and regulations. There's just sort of principles. So you're able to use and adopt the principles depending on your climate and your all of those sorts of factors. So it's very sort of it's not a set group of rules. That's what I love about permaculture.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, when they first get exposed to permaculture, they associate it with specific techniques like composting or mulching or, the dreaded herb spiral. It really is this way of thinking about the world. There's core ethics and principles and then really good design processes that help us design things and gardens and homes and businesses that are appropriate for particular context.
It's the intellect behind it. It's so rigorous, and it's the rationale behind things really has a meaning, so things are placed for practicality purposes too.
Yeah, it's really important to think about things before you do them, but it's also really important to do things and not get caught up in the detail. So I like the balance that permaculture brings in that sense, that it's a way of actually getting out there and starting where you are with what you have, but it's also a way of planning and thinking so that your effort is best value for the work that you put into it.
Well, it sounds like you're in the best place possible. It also sounds like Daylesford's going to have an influx of Australians.
It's a pretty nice little community.
Wanting to hook up with these like-minded souls, because I was really privileged to talk to Matt Purbrick from The Village the other day. From Grown and Gathered. He mustn't be far from you too.
No, they're only about half an hour away, and we've been trying to hook up for a barbecue for the last couple of months, and we're definitely going to do it this summer.
Oh, wonderful. I hope Lentil brings her stale cake to share.
I hope so too.
Thank you so much for your time, Nick. It's been an absolute pleasure.
My pleasure, Linda.
I really enjoyed chatting to Nick today. So inspiring. I've got a list of jobs to go home and start, especially because the spring holidays is coming up. Now, if you like our podcast, please tell your friends about it. You can also go to iTunes. I'd love you to leave a little review if you could possibly. And also, it really helps other people and other gardeners find out what we're doing here on the Garden Clinic Digs Deeper podcast. Please connect with me either on Instagram and on Facebook, The Garden Clinic, or Linda Ross. Would be wonderful to connect with you during the week. Happy gardening and go safely.
The best garden in the street.
G'day, Graham Ross here. Now, you all know I love my gardening, and we all know that Sea Sol is simply fantastic for keeping your garden healthy and looking great. But did you know that Sea Sol reduces transplant shock and dramatically increases the plant's survival rate when they're newly planted? Now, look, it's like an insurance policy for your plants. So when you're planting out your seedlings and new plants in your garden, don't just water them in, Sea Sol your plants.
Don't forget the Sea Sol.